A new poll is out on the city's mayoral and sheriff's races. Lawmakers in Tallahassee kick off the spring legislative session, and school testing is suspended in Duval County. Some of the biggest stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect, always live on the radio, and now our daily podcast is on iTunes. You can listen to the show anytime. Just ahead, all the biggest news of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can get on the line right now at 549-2937. Then later, a look ahead to One Spark and the opening of the Riverside Arts Market. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first, it's Friday, and that means it's time for our media roundtable. Lots of news from the week to go over. We're excited today to welcome Larry Hannon of the Florida Times Union.
Good to be here.
A.G. Gankarski, columnist with Folio Weekly and Florida Politics.
Hi, Melissa.
Fred Matthews, who blogs at The Examiner.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. And our own WJCT news analyst, John Brewer.
Hey, good morning.
Guys, great to have you all on the show and lots of news to discuss. But the biggest story of the week was that highly anticipated new UNF poll that came out Thursday looking at Jacksonville's mayor and sheriff races. Here are the numbers. Incumbent Mayor Alvin Brown is leading with 37% of like voters. Lenny Curry has 25% and Bill Bishop 11%. However, many voters, about a quarter of you out there, are still undecided, so there's room for the candidates to move around. Meanwhile, in the sheriff's contest, a crowded field of seven candidates. But here are the two top vote-getters as of right now. Polling at the top is Ken Jefferson with about 24% and Mike Williams 16% in a crowded field. So we're going to begin the hour with a discussion of this new poll and a look ahead to the March 24th unitary election. Let us know who you like for mayor and for sheriff. Give us a call. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. Larry Hannon, let's begin with you. Mayor Brown in the lead, but as the pollster was quick to point out, many voters are still making up their minds.
Yeah, there's going to be quite a few voters who would kind of like another option because it seems as though they've been underwhelmed by everything so far. Obviously, it's good for Brown to be in the lead. But with a quarter of the voters undecided, there's still a chance for Bill Bishop to make up a lot of ground. And if you're the incumbent mayor and you're only getting 37%, that's not that good, even in a three-way race.
Fred Matthews, campaign spokesman for Mayor Brown, says he's always run in these campaigns as though he's behind, and he will do so again. At the same time, Lenny Curry's camp is saying Lenny Curry has plenty of time to increase his share. Bill Bishop saying the two televised debates coming up, one of them next week here at WJCT, will give him a chance to improve his standing. What are your thoughts?
He's always run in these campaigns as if he were behind. He's already run in two campaigns. One was for Congress and one was for this one. I mean, it's not as if he's
one of which he lost.
Yeah, one of which he lost.
Well, he was behind.
He was behind. So it's not as if he has a whole lot of campaigns under his belt here. But I mean, this is a great time for us, certainly. It's a worse time for candidates because it's gut check time. This is reality that now sits in your plate. You know, you had some polling done your own about a month or so ago. Nobody really wants to pay for it like they did before, but now you got this poll, which everybody gets to see. Your reporters see it, and you've got to be realistic about it or put the best spin on it that you can. And one of the things that it tells me, aside from the fact that the 25% or so of people that have made up my mind, is that I think that's a lot of people who simply haven't paid any attention to this at all.
They don't even know
we're having an election that's coming.
That's right, and a lot of the people questioned John and AG you could tell they didn't know a lot about the candidates, particularly Lenny Curry and Bill Bishop. Mm-hmm. So that's the power of incumbency. A lot of people know Mayor Brown already, have an opinion about him. The opinions are less solid on the other two.
Absolutely. Look at these numbers for Curry. 15% don't think he's a strong leader, and 62% don't know or refuse to answer the question. That's 77%, if I'm adding this up right, that either don't think he's a strong leader or don't have any opinion about the guy. That's terrible. I mean, we're 2 weeks out. That's a real problem for Curry.
And really, if you look at the TV ads, we haven't learned a lot about Curry from that, except, of course, that he's not a politician. I mean, there have been a lot more negative ads than positive ads for Curry.
AG.
Well, here's the thing. You know, you've got Lenny Curry's PAC sending out mail pieces every other day talking about liberal Alvin Brown, Democrat Alvin Brown, a lot of mudslinging. You can see the effect there because the poll respondents said 43% of them said that Alvin Brown is liberal, which would be news to the other 57%, presumably. But, you know, that stuff's having an effect. And the Curry campaign, you know, has clearly spent a lot of resources and time trying to undermine Alvin Brown's image as a fiscal conservative, you know, somebody who brings people together. And, you know, that's working. At some point, though, Curry's got to pivot to the center. He's got to start branding an affirmative message. And it's going to be hard to do that because he's had to do so much messaging in this campaign to the right side of the Republican Party.
And we'll go to your calls about the city's mayor and sheriff's races in just a moment at 549-2937. Let's talk about the sheriff's race for a minute. Ken Jefferson, former PIO for the sheriff's department, a fixture on local TV for many years, is leading with 24% of voters polled. Up right behind him is Mike Williams. That's Sheriff Rutherford's handpicked successor, of course. 16% right behind him, Jimmy Holderfield, who did get the FOP endorsement. So it looks as though it'll be Ken Jefferson and someone else fighting for that other runoff spot, Fred.
I mean, this is, again, a little bit of a surprising bit of numbers. Ken Jefferson has been on the television for quite some time, but the other candidates are quite strong in terms of the sheriff's office, in terms of their own name recognition, particularly Holderfield. Mike Williams, by many folks' account, has been running a great West Side and South Side campaign, but not too much North Side, East Side. But he has the endorsement of the sheriff. And that commercial that came out, about a month ago, that has the sheriff and him shaking hands and the sheriff giving him the handoff as he walks toward the camera is a very powerful thing. But it's interesting to find Ken Jefferson sitting on top of this, again, with the same idea, but with as far as the voters are concerned, is that they really, you know, they don't know anything about these guys at all.
Yeah,
they don't know anything about these guys.
Well, Jefferson has been quietly running for this position for years.
Yeah. He ran against Rutherford in 2011, and he never stopped running. If you've been to any major event in the last 4 years, you saw him there shaking hands. You know, there was some talk a month or so ago that because there were two African-Americans in the race that the black vote was going to split. That's not happening. Cummings is not, you know, he is the Warren Lee of this race. If you remember the 2011 mayor's race, Ken Jefferson has the African-American vote, and he's almost certainly going to make the runoff. The only question now is who gets in the runoff against him.
Against him. And let's talk about the mayoral runoff for a minute. Your thoughts about that. A.G. Gankarski.
The mayoral runoff passed the 24th. I mean, right now it's looking to shape up to Brown and Curry. I'm assuming that Bill Bishop doesn't pull off a miracle in terms of these results. That being said, the question is, where do Bill Bishop supporters go? Where does Bishop go? There's a lot of bad blood in the Republican Party between the Bishop and Curry wings right now. You know, is Bishop going to, you know, play the party guy and endorse or not? And, you know, that might be the road to victory for Lenny, is if Lenny is able to bring together the Bishop coalition, you know, along with disaffected Brown supporters from 2011, that might be a shot.
John Burr.
To me, the whole thing is going to hinge on turnout. And if we're talking about a 25% turnout where just the, you know, the really politically connected people vote, I don't see how, certainly how Bill Bishop's going to win. And I think it's going to be very tough for Lenny Curry. Well, I think, you know, in the runoff, you're going to see you're going to see Curry and Brown. But in the, that turnout is just, you know, that's the key. Really.
And the Brown campaign yesterday, Fred Matthews sent out a response to the poll numbers saying that their primary focus is turnout on Election Day.
Yeah, there's no question about it. They've got to get that. With 34% of African Americans voting, saying in this poll that they prefer Curry over Brown, he's got to get turnout to tamp that down a bit. I think AG was attending the thing at St. Paul the other week, mm-hmm. where it was a surprise to everyone that the mayor didn't show up for whatever reasons, and a huge crowd there, and it basically gave Curry and Omega Allen the floor to themselves all night. It was a bit of a surprise to everybody, but these numbers tell the story. But turnout is going to be the key. There's no question about it. And whether you can stay on the air. I mean, Bishop is not on the air. when you have two at-large council people running commercials, Brochet's been running mm-hmm. them for weeks now, mm-hmm. and I saw one for a guy named Willis running in District 10
yeah.
last night. He's running a TV commercial, but nothing from Curry, from Bishop yeah. at all.
And
how are you going to do anything?
They are coming out with a TV spot, the campaign said, on I believe it's on the 8th.
Yeah. I mean, he needs to get on the air if he's going to have any chance of, you know, and a lot of people have been underwhelmed with the Curry campaign so far, but... You know, you can't beat something with nothing. And, you know, no matter how good you try to do the grassroots, if you're not on TV to a certain extent, you don't exist.
And you know, when he comes out on the 8th with all his commercials, well, that's the same time everybody else is going to double down on their commercials, too. So he could very well get drowned out on the air.
Well, we want your calls right now. We're as we discuss the biggest stories of the week, kicking off the hour with a look at the new UNF poll on the city's upcoming mayor and sheriff's races. Who will you vote for? On both sides, mayor and sheriff. Give us a call, 549-2937. David on the north side. Hey, David.
Hi. How is everyone on the panel today?
Great.
Good. Good.
Good. I have a quick comment and maybe a question in my comment. I'm wondering about the Omega Allen candidacy and why the local media is shunning her in such a fashion. The panel barely made mention of her, and as I understand, she is not being invited to one of the upcoming debates. Why is that, and could you elaborate on why the media is treating her the way that she is? And I'll take my comments off here.
Thanks, David. Let me just say, we hosted Omega Allen on this program last week. The Times Union did an extensive profile on Omega Allen. She is the fourth filed candidate. She's polling at about 2% AG.
I talked to her last night at the WOKV event. Asked her about the UNF poll. She said, well, they didn't poll anybody who knows me. you know, and that set off the tone for her remarks. She basically thought she should have been in a debate. She blamed it on the good old boy network that she wasn't. She blamed it on cronyism. And, you know, if she's able to make that case over the head of the media, it might bring her up in the March 24th election. You know, there's a really strong case to be made that perhaps she should have been in at least one of the debates so that the people of Jacksonville could hear what she has to say. And I think that's going to be one of the big questions of this campaign.
If this was a – if March 24th decided the election, I would think it's more justified to keep her out because then we know it's really against the top two contenders. But the fact that this is just narrowing it down from 4 to 2, I don't see any reason why we can't have all four in right now and then just go to 2 for the runoff.
Fred.
The media doesn't make your campaign. That's an organ. The media doesn't make or doesn't break your campaign. You make your campaign by the strategy you put together. Omega Allen and Curry, again, looking at that St. Paul thing last week, there were two candidates there. They were treated equally. Mm-hmm. But when Curry got the question about money and how much it meant to his campaign and why these people are donating to you, it was very simple. It's very straightforward. You need the money in order to have a viable campaign to get the word out, to tell people who you are and who the other person is not. And that's just reality of how American politics is run on any level. If you don't have it, you just get it. Mayor Brown didn't have the greatest lift in his election campaign, but he had the money. Nationally and locally, he had the money, and that made the difference when the time came for him to step up.
That is an excellent point. You know, he has money coming in from the state party. Curry has money coming from the state Republican Party. Mm-hmm. You saw this money coming into the PACs on both sides. And really, we're seeing the future of campaigning in Jacksonville with the mayoral race. We're seeing, you know, outside money. We're seeing
outside operatives.
Yes, outside operatives coming in to run the operations. And you're seeing kind of a generic messaging on both sides. We're going to improve your community. And the messaging is crafted by people who have been here for a few weeks.
And not only that, both of these two front runners are able to tap into a national donor network on either side.
And keep in mind now, again, just on Omega Allen and her point, is that she was a Republican. up until this race. Everyone, and certainly in the black community, knew her as a Republican. She came back here, joined that party, had been active, tried to be active in the party, and was basically not allowed to go very high in it. And for her to jump up now, and everybody looks and says she's not a party affiliation, well, what does that mean?
And why wasn't she allowed to go higher in the party?
Well, because they still aren't very receptive, quite frankly, to African Americans. They haven't been able to. The same problem nationally is here locally. The local Republican Party has not been able to find a way to incorporate African Americans in their party. It goes back to Mark Little's time when he ran and was courted by certain people in the party, but he was never able to get the full support. Jefferson, who just ran in a local election, has been a long time, I think Lawrence Jefferson, has been a long time African-American Republican, but not getting any support from the party to make a run at it.
Well, it's really a circular problem, too, because you're absolutely right. But also, black candidates don't get, in the Republican Party, don't get much interest from the African-American voters.
No, that's it.
You know, so it's a very tough cycle to break.
And that's nationally. You look at African Americans who've run as Republicans in other states, oftentimes they don't even get 10% of the black vote. It's African Americans are the most loyal Democratic Party voters. They vote based on the D after the name more than just about anyone else.
And if you're just tuning in, we're discussing the top stories of the week right now with our Friday Media Roundtable, the best analysis you'll hear anywhere. We'll keep taking your calls at 549-2937. Also making headlines this week, Governor Scott the other day opened the 2015 legislative session Tuesday in Tallahassee with talk about Florida exceptionalism. He called for tax cuts and new revenues to make to make college more affordable. Among other priorities, gambling, Medicaid, pot, all on the agenda in Tallahassee this session. A.G. Gankarski.
Yeah, Rick Scott's State of the State address was, an assured delivery. But, there are issues with the legislature, too. I mean, he's still got to basically heal the divide between himself and the legislature after, what happened before the session. You've got a lot of Democrats, especially South Florida Democrats, who are advancing progressive options, like Dwight Bullard down south, who actually is advancing a marijuana legalization bill for small quantities. And you're seeing these other things coming into play, too. I mean, speaking of marijuana, I mean, you saw a medical necessity defense for marijuana succeeding this week. So the Republicans in the legislature and Rick Scott have to find a way to basically, accommodate this progressive wave that's coming, even though they have the legislative majority, and even though it all looks good for now. There is this real dialogue and this real tension between North and South Florida and the Republicans and the Democrats.
Yeah, and a few of the other issues that are expected to generate a lot of attention, whether to allow guns on the state's college campuses, how to put together the state's budget, water a big issue, clean water in Florida, marijuana, as AG mentioned, there's going to be an alimony bill that could get a lot of attention, and of course, health care, how to pay for health care. John Burr.
Well, there's a big local issue that's flying under the radar right now, and that is the St. John's River dredging. The city and the state are going to have to come up between them with about $380 million to make this, close to a $1 billion project work. The city's not a fount of money right now. So the state's going to be asked to pick up a bunch of that. Now, I haven't heard a word about it. When the last days of the session come along and they start divvying up the pie, where the money goes, that's going to be the big issue for Northeast Florida.
Fred Matthews.
Well, that is true. The other thing, of course, is looking at our own UNF Shands situation there. They've got a big hole that they've got to begin to fill. Part of it, and it caught in a bit of a debate between the federal government and the state of Florida, again, over the same Medicaid money.
Right, the low-income pool funding going away.
Going away. And the legislature could be able to weigh in on that if they will, because, I mean, the folks at Shands are saying that if they don't get this soon, this $10 million hole they're looking at, they could very well be in a position of having to close.
Now, right? The Jacksonville Civic Council, which is comprised of local CEOs, has indicated to me that what they may come out with very shortly is a recommendation that Duval County set up an independent taxing district for UF Health, the former Shands, similar to what's already been done in Miami-Dade and Tampa, Hillsborough County, as a way to mitigate the lack of the Medicaid expansion in Florida. That could be a potential fix, but getting that passed would be a heavy lift. That independent taxing district referendum idea in the library system didn't pass.
Why don't they just come out in favor of getting the Medicaid expansion passed? I mean, that would settle the lift problem.
Because that then would be an agreement with the federal government, which would be in agreement with President Obama, and they're not going to have any trouble doing that.
And let's remember that this is probably the last legislative session that won't be impacted by an immediate political race. Come next year, we'll know if Rubio is running for re-election to the Senate. If he's not, probably half the people in Tallahassee will be eyeing that seat, and we'll also have the presidential election next year. So this is really the year to try to get something done when politics isn't hanging over the heads quite as much.
549-2937, Linda in Bay Meadows. Go ahead, Linda.
Yes. I wanted to call to comment about saying that African Americans are the most loyal segment, section of the Democratic Party. And that certainly is true. But I would like us to put it in context of history. When President Lincoln set the slaves free, African Americans were Republicans. We were Republicans. And as I would say, as a new indication, the Republican Party left us. We didn't leave them. And they've made it apparently clear that there are certain segments of the Republican Party that have, that verbally seem to have the rights to use a civil language and innuendos, that even though I may be with them fiscally, I cannot accommodate them because of the way that they go about demonizing people that are others. And so if any Republicans are out there, try to actually buck your party and come up with a coalition, you might be able to get some support. Thanks so much.
Linda in Bay Meadows on the line. AG.
Well, we're seeing that kind of thing done in the mayoral race with the Bishop campaign. You know, building a coalition outside of traditional lines, including an outreach to Northwest Jacks, which, you know, many people in the Brown camp say is an authentic and sort of a new development for Bill Bishop. You know, that being said, I mean, a big complaint that's been made has been, you know, the coded language that the Republican Party uses in some communications. It's an old thing. And in this market, you had a lot of Republicans who were Democrats in the 90s who switched over, sort of that 1990s Democrat switched to Republican Party. And you see sort of the language that was used that's kind of old school. You see it in ads even today. Some of the mayoral ads from the PACs, you know, are using language that people on the other side say is coded.
They see it as racially inflammatory. Fred Matthews.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what you said is that a number of African American voters are in line with the fiscal policies of the Republican Party, but their social policies and are just not there. I mean, Jennifer Carroll, former Lieutenant Governor Jennifer Carroll, issues were a lot of them were self-inflicted. Ask her today how she feels about the Republican Party. Ask her how she feels about it. Ask Mark Little how he feels about the Republican Party. You know, he's still around. He's still suffering from that. He was a big media figure here. He still writes books now. But he was a big deal for the Republicans back then. But he cannot get the time of day in many African-American communities because, aren't you Mark Little and you're a Republican?
Right now, the Republican Party is a white party. It's not getting blacks, Hispanics, Asians. They're all trending 75% to 80% Democrat, as are Jewish voters for that matter. You know, it's a white Christian party right now. And while that makes it strong at times, they may win the mayoral race this year. They're having a problem because demographics are changing. The white population in this country is decreasing. The minority population is growing. We may be a majority-majority in the next 20 to 30 years.
We will be. Yeah. That brings back to the mayoral, the May runoff. If it's Mayor Brown, Lenny Curry will get the white Republican vote. For Mayor Brown, he must get the black vote and enough of the white vote to win, and it will hang on that small slice of voters.
The Audrey Moran Democrats, as I've dubbed them, they are going to decide this race.
That real small slice of voters, because again, it could be 75-80% of the voters don't vote to begin with.
Yeah, people are not excited about this election at all.
Well, let's move on then. And by the way, it's 549-2937 to give us a call. Right now we want to talk about the Duval County Public Schools. They called off testing again today, the fourth day that tens of thousands of students around the state were supposed to be writing essays for the state's new online annual exams. This from the TU. Superintendent Nicole Lividi says he'll try the testing again later today. By the way, the school system also has a new teacher pay agreement, and Vitti's contract unanimously extended, a big vote of confidence from the Duval County School Board. He'll be here through 2019. This gets back to the controversy over whether students are being inundated with too much testing. Governor Scott has said they're going to look at that this legislative session. AG.
2 points. First of all, regarding the testing, I talked to activist Colleen Wood last night. She was telling me about the testing just basically being a disaster throughout the state with myriad issues. And, you know, as these testing delays and inconsistencies and problems mount, you have to ask yourself, is the methodology of the test even reliable at this point if you keep delaying tests and restarts and all of that? Secondly, regarding Vitti, there is a real schism. You've got the Jack's Chamber and, you know, people like that strongly advocating for this early renewal of his contract. You talk to teachers and you hear many of them say that the morale is not what it should be. They don't feel connected to superintendent. So it almost seemed like a power play to say, all right, this guy is here for the duration. And you have to wonder if this is intended to give the rank and file a message.
Well, I think what people want, the leaders of this community want, is some consistency in that office. We've had kind of a merry-go-round as in superintendent in the last, 15 years or so. And they like what Vitti's doing, and they want to keep him there. And as far as the staff and the teachers go, I can't remember a time when they weren't complaining about being disconnected from the administration and nobody's listening to them. And, you know, this is not a new complaint. It doesn't end up in Vitti's lap.
Volume is louder.
Well,
I would agree with that. Yeah, there have been a lot of rapidly imposed changes. Not all of them coming out of Vitti's office, by the way, Fred. Some of them come from the state.
Well, they are, but this has been a sort of quiet battle over there on the South Bank, and I think a bit surprising to some people. But if you've been looking at it, even from the time that Vitti was selected for this position, when he was selected, it was a bit out of nowhere for some people. But for those who voted for him and supported him the time he was elected to be in the pool of selectees, it seemed to be a fait accompli. And for at least two members on there on the board that time, Paula Wright and Constance Hall, they had their votes somewhere else, and they were pushing that hard and carried that candidate around. And when they discovered, only to find themselves, when they brought the candidate's name forth, to find him completely washed out and all other board members voting against their candidate, it left a bitter taste in their mouth. They've tried to get along with Vitti. They've looked at it. They stalled on getting him this extension of contract, and now it's boiling over, and board members are saying they feel pressured, and they don't know how this vote came up last night, who brought it forth. What are you talking about? You guys are on the board, and you don't know what's going on, or you feel pressured, and then you look in the article that's published, and you find Wayne Weaver, saying, hey, everything's great. We need to do this. What? Does he have a vote all of a sudden?
Vitti's different than some other superintendents in that he really doesn't need the school board. He has other options. And I think that's one of the reasons why the business community.
Well,
really
there was talk about another school district snapping him up if he didn't resign. Robert on the south side. Go ahead, Robert. All right, Robert, give us a call back. Fred at the beaches. Hello, Fred. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've marked my ballot as you talked this morning.
First Coast Connect quick picks.
I'm sorry. Who are you voting for, Fred?
I'm not saying.
Okay.
But I would like to say that there are a lot of good people running. The straw ballot seems to be an issue we've solved before in the past. And does it mean that someone who lives, say, in the Beaches community would not be able to serve on these boards?
No, I don't believe so.
No.
Yeah. But Fred, thanks for calling. Thanks for voting. Mark on the west side. Go ahead, Mark.
Good morning. My question is about, well, not question, the comment is about the school superintendent. I am not a teacher, but I run in circles with, for some reason, lots and lots of teachers. And not only don't they feel support from this guy, they actively dislike this guy. I can't, there's always been, teachers who feel, have felt disaffected with the school superintendent. That's, just the price of doing business, I guess. But I mean, I actively ask, and it's hard to find one. I don't think I've met one in the last year that actively likes this guy or supports him or thinks he's doing a great job. It's like 100%. It's really odd.
Thanks for the call, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm talking about is, you've got teachers and it's like they're a close-knit community. They're talking to each other all the time. And, you're seeing this mounting discord within the teacher population. One of the issues that have plagued Duval County schools for a long time is teacher turnover. A lot of them don't make it to the five-year mark, so you get inexperienced teachers in the classroom disproportionately serving lower-income communities.
Yeah. To be fair to Vitti, that's a national trend.
Right.
That's not something that
you can
hang on him.
But we are local, and the big point of comparison is St. Johns County, to the south, which is, lauded by many as the perfect school district. They don't have the issues that Duval County does, et cetera.
And that's due to socioeconomic factors.
Right, but, people make that comparison.
Yeah.
So, if you look at this teacher turnover issue, it's got to be solved on a local level, and Vitti's got to find a way.
Robert on the south side. Go ahead, Robert. We got you back.
Yes. I want to say that I do agree totally with the teacher problem. It is horrendous. Sorry, state of affairs. I do also want to congratulate Mayor Brown for doing as well as he has for over the years. I didn't really appreciate it when they laughed when we said pot. It's not going to happen until 2020, unfortunately. But Medicaid is the most important thing. The most important thing. Anything else is irrelevant. Politics hopefully will not get in the way. Turning down $50 million 2 years in a row is unacceptable.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
Well, the pressure, I think it's fair to say, will mount on the state legislature to take that Medicaid money at some point.
Well, yes, it is mounting, but, I have to agree with the rest of the panel. The chance of really tipping the balance toward taking the Medicaid money is slim, very slim.
And finally, lots of news we went through, but we now want to touch on our weekly roundup of the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from across the Sunshine State. Luckily for us, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Only in Florida do people try to steal planes worth in the millions of dollars. Officials in Ocala say 23-year-old Juan Cerrone was caught tampering with an aircraft at the Ocala International Airport. A member of the ground crew says Cerrone was simply trying to get to Chicago. The PC-12 plane Cerrone was trying to steal and fly off with is worth $2.5 million. Police say they found hundreds of dollars worth of damage to the aircraft, including oxygen masks pulled down and inflated life vests.
The shocking part is, though, Cala has an international airport.
Only in Florida do phallic-shaped birthday cakes lead to a BB gun shootout. Whoa. Christopher Taft of Holly Hills is behind bars. Police say he shot his sister in the backside with a BB gun after she gave him a phallic-shaped birthday cake for his 21st birthday.
I didn't know Carvel had that.
Now, even low-power air guns like the famous Daisy Red Ryder have muzzle velocity of 350 feet per second, which can break the skin. Others can kill small game and can shoot at velocities of more than 2,000 feet per second.
Where do you find this stuff, Melissa?
It's like picking...
Deleted scene from a Christmas
it's
story.
It's the most low-hanging fruit you have ever seen.
Thank God, Florida.
And finally, only in Florida do drivers cause mayhem on the roads, not by texting while driving, but by rolling a blunt while behind the wheel.
All right.
Oh, wow.
26-year-old James Antoine... speaking of medical marijuana, 26-year-old James Antoine of Port St. Lucie was caught swerving erratically. Police say he was trying to prepare his joint while driving.
What happened to the days of gin and juice?
And you thought
laid back.
And you thought texting and driving was a problem.
Oh, you guys are the best. Thanks, Fred Matthews, A.G. Gankarski, John Burr, and Larry Hannon. Have a wonderful weekend.
Mind on my money and my money on my mind.
There you go.
Still to come, composer Paul Williams as he performs tonight, plus a look ahead to One Spark and Riverside Arts Market. Stay with us.
Do you remember your first time?
My first time? First time of what?
It's a little uncomfortable. Should I talk about it now?
Your first time listening to NPR's Morning Edition, that is.
I was 6 years old riding around in my parents' car, and I was like, what is this stuff? And I just kept listening.
No matter how many times you've listened, listen again tomorrow to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
I'm Christian McBride, and on the next Jazz Night in America, the Modern Jazz Generation. It's the latest project from pianist Marcus Roberts.
Like if you cook a meal using your great-grandmother's recipe for a chicken dish, well, you're hungry, it's good, it's relevant, that's modern.
The Modern Jazz Generation. That's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Join WJCT and the Jacksonville Public Education Fund on Tuesday, March 10th for a special evening to talk about teaching and student success. Refreshments and a panel discussion will be followed by a screening of the new documentary, 180 Days Hartsville. The event is Tuesday, March 10th at WJCT Studios from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. RSVP at wjct.org/events/teaching-transformation.
Welcome back. Well, the legendary Paul Williams performs tonight in Jacksonville. Williams has written a staggering array of pop hits spanning decades. You know him from Old Fashioned Love Song, We've Only Just Begun, to Rainy Days and Mondays, even The Rainbow Connection. Williams is a music icon. I spoke with him about tonight's big show.
To come to town in the wonderful warm weather in Jacksonville is a treat, but to come and perform with a symphony like the Jacksonville Symphony is just, you know, for a songwriter, that's about as good as it gets. To hear your music performed by a great orchestra, it sounds like it was written by a grown-up.
Don't miss this special treat. It's tonight, an evening of songs and stories with Paul Williams and the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra. Tonight at 8 p.m. at the Times Union Center. Well, hard to believe, but the city's third annual One Spark Festival is just about a month away. The massive crowdfunding event has so much going on, and guess what? You can be involved because they need volunteers. Communications Director Meredith O'Malley Johnson is here to tell us all about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can't believe we're coming up again on One Spark already. How about that?
Yeah. It's wild. Third
year already.
It's gone fast.
Yeah, third year is upon us. So last year you had about 649 volunteers. This year you need even more.
Yeah, we're aiming for about 800 this year. We just want to make sure the attendee creator experience is amazing for everybody. And we have a lot of different volunteer jobs at OneSpark, something for everybody. We need videographers, photographers, customer service and registration squad, guides, tech crew, stage crew. So really something fun for everybody to do.
A lot of people want to be part of it just for the fun of it, but you do have a few incentives, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You get OneSpark branded t-shirts, tote bags. We give you snacks and drinks during your shifts. You get to meet great people. That's one of the best things. Some of my best friends now are people I met who volunteered at OneSpark. And also, if you work 20 plus hours, you get to come to our exclusive volunteer recognition celebration. And every year we have it at a really fun location with great catering and drinks. Last year we had it on the rooftop of Mosh. And this year's location is a secret until
Ooh.
We reveal that.
Well, what secrets can you give away about this spring's event? We've talked a little bit about it on the show before, but you've got a great lineup this year.
Yeah, this OneSpark Speaker Summit is going to be a really big deal on April 7th, and that is actually the day before the Creator Showcase kicks off. Amazing speakers, Jeff Hoffman from Priceline.com, Tamara Medelson from Eventbrite. And then we also, this year, for the first time, have a OneSpark 5K the Saturday of the festival. That's April 11th. You can sign up for that, too. We have an expanded food village, four blocks of that. And probably the biggest change we made this year is we have crowdfunding that you actually get rewards for, just like Kickstarter.com. So if you contribute $50 to a creator project that you think is awesome, you can actually get something cool in return.
Let me just talk about that food village one more time, because our own genius, in-house genius, Sean Birch, has given you the perfect branding for that expanded food village. You need to change it right now to One Spork.
Yes, our graphic designer had fun with that.
Now let's talk about what the winners. You've tweaked sort of the metrics of this over the years. How people can come away with cash and also connections mm-hmm. and potential startup funding. What can the top vote getters expect this year?
Sure. Well, we have six categories this year. We have two new ones: education and social good. And in each of those six categories, the top voted project gets $15,000. That's an increase from $10,000 from last year. So all of you at home listening or in your car, you can vote for projects and actually help to figure out who those winners are. We also have juried awards in each category, 3 to 5 jurors that are subject experts, and they go around and look at every project in their category, and they will award a $15,000 award too. And the project that gets the most individual contributions as well gets an additional $15,000. So if you're keeping track, mm-hmm. that's 13 $15,000 awards at OneSpark this year, on top of our $150,000 crowdfund divided out based on popular vote.
What are some of the success stories that have come out of OneSpark so far?
Sure. Well, I think one I really love is Neuro Initiative.
Yeah.
They won the health and science category last year. And what they do is they're trying to, solve ALS and Parkinson's and Alzheimer's by using gaming technology to map neurons in the brain. It's amazing. And they've really made so many connections at OneSpark. They actually don't talk as much about the money as the connections they made, because now they have all these collaborators that are moving in the same direction they are and helping to solve these issues. Also, just small businesses. I love to talk about Pratt Guys. They built that beautiful pergola in Hemming Park.
Yes, yes.
And they'd been in business for 10 years here in Jacksonville. The month after OneSpark was their biggest month ever in sales. So, a lot of people think it's just for idea stage. No, if you're a small business, that visibility can be huge for your business.
Absolutely. And the festival is such a big deal for downtown. I mean, it transformed the energy and the character of downtown when it happened last year, and it's expected to hopefully continue that momentum again.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the biggest changes we've seen, DBI does that downtown poll every year. And, young people never have seen a thriving downtown. So when we encourage them to come down during OneSpark, there's like, oh, downtown's cool. There's really cool stuff to do. And we've seen huge public opinion shifts, especially among young people, on You know, there is parking downtown. Downtown is very safe. There is stuff to do. So I think that's been one of the most exciting things for me to see as far as, you know, helping out our downtown become what I think we all know it can be.
Absolutely. And so if you want to be part of all this, you just need to go to the website, onespark.com.
That's correct. And I hope we get some volunteers out there that sign up. It's going to be a lot of fun this year.
Meredith O'Malley Johnson, Communications Director at OneSpark. As always, great to see you. Thanks.
Thanks.
And we're back in a moment.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
The Florida legislature is in session, and Capitol Report is your nightly connection to what's happening in Tallahassee as lawmakers debate and decide issues that affect all Floridians, such as expanding health care and gambling, protecting the state's water resources, private versus public schools, and prison reform. Hear Capitol Report each weeknight during the legislative session on this Florida public radio station.
Weeknights at 6:30 on WJCT 89.9.
Join us weeknights at 7 for music. From symphonies to the latest indie music, you'll hear it all weeknights at 7 only on 89.9 FM.
Deep below sea, darling, on deep blue sea. Deep below.
Welcome back. Finally this hour, you know spring has sprung when the Riverside Arts Market officially opens for the season. That's happening tomorrow under the Fuller Warren Bridge. Ram's Kristen Bennett is here now with a preview. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. It's always good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You know spring is here when you guys open up from winter hours to spring hours. Big change.
Big change. Yeah, we really don't go anywhere. We take that 1 week between Christmas and New Year's off, but we've been around with abbreviated hours for the last couple of months. But tomorrow's the big day. Full-blown market, all of our vendors, entertainment, lots of fun under the bridge.
What's going to be happening this year? What can we look forward to?
Well, it's the same big market you are used to seeing. Lots of local entertainment, local vendors, produce, artists, food artisans, lunch under the bridge. We love our regular vendors. We have some new vendors, as always, and vendors mm-hmm. can always apply. We're bringing new vendors in all of the time. We have some things in the works that I'm not quite ready to share.
Oh.
You'll see as they come about. But one thing that we're really working on this year is redirecting the focus in our Farmers Row. So in Farmers Row, we're going to really be looking at farmers, bringing in some new farmers that are growing seasonal local produce so that we truly are a farmer's market there at Ram in our Farmers Row. And excited about that, we'll have our new farmer liaison, Katie Delaney, who's just joined us. We'll be there every week to answer visitors' questions about what's growing seasonally, giving them ideas about how to cook with produce that they may not recognize. Lots of good things to look forward to in Farmers Row, particularly.
Right, and that local sustainable agriculture is such a big part of the local food movement. And at the same time, you've always got interesting, different live entertainment.
We do. Tomorrow for opening day, of course, we always have our parade through the market where we welcome our vendors back for the season and get everybody excited about the year to come. We invite all of the members of the public to come join us to march and welcome our vendors and, you know, be festive, bring your hula hoops and your baton twirling and all of that great stuff. The Ronan School is going to be leading that march and visitors are welcome to join us. We'll start at 10:15 and then have a brief opening ceremony and declare the market officially open.
Isn't there a parade?
There is. There is. We do a parade through the market. So it's a lot of fun. It really is about welcoming the vendors back, waving to them, making sure they're really excited, and giving the public an opportunity to participate in those festivities for opening morning.
It's Riverside Arts Market coming back with spring hours tomorrow, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. under the Fuller Warren Bridge in Riverside. Rain or shine?
Rain or shine. We're looking at good weather tomorrow, so fingers crossed. But it never rains under the bridge. We want to remind our visitors, if you can get from your parking space to the bridge, then you are fully protected by that shade of the Fuller Warren. We love that. Yes,
but I did peek at the forecast. It looks like you're going to have a really nice weekend.
I'm excited.
I know.
It's just what we need for opening day. Spring is definitely upon us.
Spring is here. It will be cold tonight, but apparently getting nice and spring-like tomorrow. So good wishes for that.
Thank you. I hope everybody comes out, hashtag under the bridge, and you know, share your photos, invite your friends, and come out. We're here through every Saturday through December 19th, I believe is the date this year. So we're there every week.
Busy lady. She's Kristen Bennett, the director of RAM, the Riverside Arts Market, riversideartsmarket.com, hashtag under the bridge. Get out there tomorrow and enjoy it. Enjoy the start of spring. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. This show's producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. Make sure to catch our daily podcast. It's now up on iTunes. And send any email with feedback to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Next on Diane Rehm, a panel of journalists joins Diane for analysis of the week's top national news stories. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.